RadioInfluence.com.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this Tuesday, July 3rd edition of the Landry Football Podcast. Hope you're having a great start of the summer calendar. Folks, football's right around the corner. It's a little bit of time kind of regrouping myself, doing some research work, getting ready for the season, spending some time at coaching clinics and doing some seminars for teams. So it's kind of got the feel of football season, but quite frankly, this is what I do in the off season a lot, because during the season you do your scouting work and your consulting work, but most of the on-site stuff in the traveling that I do is done this time of year, visiting with college programs and teams and doing some seminars and coaching clinics and working with their coaching staffs and scouting staffs and whatnot. And along with that, I recently spoke at a symposium talking about football, and it was really more talking football at all levels, where we are as football, not college football, not the NFL, not high school, not youth football, the whole development of football, where it is in terms of the whole concussion, CTE issues. So we're going to get into that, kind of take you back to where, why we've gotten here, what's really happening, and where things are headed from a football standpoint on a lot of different levels. So we're going to get into that. We've got some really good questions to get to today. We're not going to be able to get to all of them, but we're going to get to four or five of them. And we got the rest of them we'll try to get on Thursday. We're going to take a look at some of the, time permitting, some of the NFC coordinator movements and changes. We're going to have a look at the Arizona Cardinals, as well as a look at some of the toughest schedules in college football as we get a look at kind of who's where and where things are headed. Also going to look on, probably on Thursday we'll get to it, some programs in college football going up and going down. So lots of things to get to today. But I wanted to start talking a little bit about the history of football and where we are today. And there is, as you know, growing concern about concussions, rightly so. There's been a lot of studies, and you've heard me talk about it. What has changed is over the years, we are in depth medically with understanding what goes on with the effects of playing football. We didn't have that in the 60s, you know, investigating and researching the players that played in the 30s and 40s and 20s. We're growing as a society in that regard, in every regard, but as we focus on this, we're learning more. And when you are taking a sample of 100 players and studying their brains after death and realizing that 98 of them had CTE, we're all fooling ourselves if we don't think that there's not significant repercussions from playing the sport of football. What does it mean, though? What does it mean for the sport, where we're going? Well, again, I want to go back into the days of when football started. Football is, relatively speaking, a new sport, American football, our football. If you go back, you've heard me talk about it, it started in the Northeast in college. Didn't have pro football really relevant until you got into the 50s. There was the All-American Football League prior to that. Wasn't taken seriously. It was basically more of kind of a carnival circus atmosphere is how it looked like. Guys did it just for couple of bucks here or there. So pro football is a baby. College football's been around a lot longer. And it started in the Northeast, Princeton and Rutgers playing that first organized game of football as we know it. But as it took place then, it was basically rugby. The derivatives of football come from rugby, which is an older sport. And football back in those days were very barbaric. There was no passing game. Certainly no advancement in pads and helmets. Leather hats with a little padding is all they had. And they would hit, and there were a lot of injuries. And obviously, with the lack of medical advancement, there are so many players that died on the field. And some of it was due to the action on the field. Some of it was due to guys, you know, people coming in, you know, other players just pulling them by the feet off the field or lifting them and maybe suffered a broken neck and died because how they cared for them. Obviously, it's changed drastically over the years. But it became so barbaric that the sport was, consider this, with about 30 schools playing football at that time. There was a period, a two-week period in October in the 20s. There were 11 deaths on the football field in a two-week period. Can you imagine if you hear of a player that dies today and consider how many high school players, junior high players, college players at all levels, NFL players, how rare is it that someone has a serious injury? Ryan Shazier had the most significant one recently, and we know he's getting better and he's going to be okay by the grace of God. Thank you. But can you imagine how bad it was? So football was considered barbaric, and it was going to be abolished. President Roosevelt was a fan of football, played football in college. You've heard me tell part of this story. And he fought to keep it alive. And that's when the NCAA was formed. The NCAA was not formed for the purposes that it serves today of putting rules. It was formed to put together a different type of rules and was to protect the players from barbaric actions because there was no regulatory body. So, okay, we're going to have a regulatory body. We're going to have certain rules written up. And President Truman got to the powers that be and had a meeting of the premier coaches, Amos Alonzo Stagg type guys, come in. And he said, if you don't clean up the sport, if you don't make it safer, I will abolish it. It will be abolished. We cannot have deaths. We cannot have significant injuries. I mentioned 11 deaths in 2 weeks, but there were countless other people that were paralyzed because of, again, how the sport was handled in terms of dealing with injuries, but also how they played it. So that's when he encouraged them to develop a forward pass element. And basically, it was the coaches that came up with it, but it was a part of making the game safer. So why do I bring this up? Well, I bring it up because, again, this was a different era and age. None of us are listening to this. We're around then. This is part of studying I did. When I was in college, I did some independent research and independent studies for college credit. I actually studied under at LSU, one of the premier sports and society experts that go back to studying the Olympic Games and whatnot. So I did a lot of research and looked up old articles, did some interviews, I still have the transcripts of them, of people that are obviously no longer with us that maybe were a part of it or were young when it happened and remembered certain things. And so finding out a lot of this information was intriguing, guys, now 25, 30 years ago when I did the research. So as things have developed, you know, into the 60s and 70s, there was dramatic changes. But the changes began to take place in the 20s and 30s. And then it became the 40s and 50s, where it was still, by modern-day terms, barbaric, but less so than, again, it was in the teens, in the 20s, in the 30s. So football has been under scrutiny for a long time, and I bring that up, because now it's under scrutiny every bit as much. Well, let me back that up. It is under far more scrutiny today because we have social media. We have instant information. So there's going to be a lot more criticism, a lot more information about what happened and what happens in certain situations. And there are going to be criticism, changing the game too much. It's no longer fun. Not the game I grew up with. You know, and then you got the other criticism. It's too barbaric. I'm not going to let my kids play it. So I bring this up because the sport's under attack. And I could sit here and tell you, I think fairly accurately, that I would project that the popularity of college football in the NFL. NFL and college football, the two most popular sports in this country. Far ahead of baseball, far ahead of NASCAR, far ahead of basketball. I don't think that's going to waver in my lifetime. Now, it may not be as popular 10 years from now, 20 years from now, maybe even less popular. I don't know. It's still far and away most popular. But to think that it's never going to be different is foolhardy. I'm going to go back to those days in the 20s, in the 30s. You know the most popular sport in this country? It was 1A. It was boxing and horse racing. There was no football. Football, again, really hadn't started. Baseball was very popular. Baseball was new. You know, Babe Ruth hadn't come in yet. It was popular, but it was very, very new. And so you didn't have auto racing. Basketball was something that came later that was invented to give people something to do indoors in the cold winter months living in the North. That's what the sport was. Now we're open to a lot more sports, and so people's interests are spread out a lot more. Golf was a popular sport, but it wasn't, and golf was around, but golf was mainly until Bobby Jones, Walter Hagen, and then Harry Vardon started to come over into the States. That was popular, but again, completely different world. So to think that, I don't know, 75 years from now, that some other sport, you know, one of the sports that we follow may be the fourth or fifth most popular, might not be the most popular. I think it's, first of all, we're never going to know. We're not going to be around to see it, most of us. But to think that it can't change is foolhardy. And so this is the point of what I want to get at. And I've struggled with this as we look at football. The participation in youth football has been down 12% for the last 7 to 8 years, each and every year, down 12% more. 12%, 12%, another 12%. The participation in youth football is really going down. We know why. Parents are hearing all these stories about CTE, the effects of it. They don't want their kids playing football. Listen, I understand it. As a parent, you can understand it. There's a concern. The same people that will sit there and pull for their team and go nuts and go for every game, watch games on TV, tailgate parties, play fantasy football, bet on games, basically take their whole fall and put their whole social calendar around football, won't let their kids play football because of the dangers of it. It's okay for other kids to play it, but I'm not letting my kid play it. And I'm not criticizing them. In fact, I completely understand it. So I think that needs to be understood. And there are definitely some things that the league is doing. I don't think enough, but they're doing some things with USA football, teaching kids how to properly tackle. Over time, the very thing that sold this game of football is now becoming its ruination in terms of the growth at the grassroots level. They sold the big hits. You know, head-to-head hits and knock somebody out. That's great, right? Well, boxing was the number one sport in this country, and it is not on the radar. Now, MMA is big. That's taken over the popularity, and that's barbaric, definitely. I mean, it's physical. Hockey's definitely physical. But football is getting a beating in terms of the popularity because of the fact that it's so physical and people don't want to play it at the youth level. Parents don't want to let their kids play. So now we're dealing with, okay, it's sold it on its barbaric nature. Now they're having to strip of that. They have to change the rules, the targeting penalties, the head-to-head contact, all the things that you moan and groan and bitch about. Well, the very thing that's, quite frankly, folks, I hate to say it, it's a necessity of where we are. I certainly remember. So sport went from the 50s to the 60s. With the advancement of certain rules in the 70s, we started to have some changes as well, which you could do. This is where it really began to become more, let's open it up offensively. The AFL had a tremendous impact on the NFL. They don't want to admit it, but it did. The AFL is wide open, throw the football. what you saw was the NFL say, we need to make some changes, rule changes. You can't chuck a guy 5 yards, beyond 5 yards. You could run guys into the seats before. Called the Mel Blount rule. They change it. Okay, it's not fair to the defense, and we get it. If everybody has to play by the same rules, you're having the same disadvantages. You have to play defense differently. How do you do it? Where are we going? Well, folks, let me tell you where we're not going. We're not going back. Okay, like it or not, we're not going back. And I'm someone that's had to adapt. I work in football. So if I didn't like it, I mean, if I retired tomorrow, I would still watch football and still love football. And there are certain things that I don't like as much about it today as I did years ago. But I understand, and more importantly, accept the fact that the game is changing and will continue to change, and it will be more and more to advancement of safety on most issues. Now, the hypocrisy is we play too many games. Well, that's not going to change, right? Because we're not going to cut down the amount of games because they want your money. That flies in the face of safety. But while they play those games, they're going to try to do everything they can to make it safer. You can't make the game safe. Now, I say this. People say, it's a barbaric game. Quit trying to make the game safe because you're going to have injuries anyway. Well, folks, that's stupid. Think about what you're saying. You know, that's like saying, well, people are going to get in car accidents. So why bother putting red lights and stop signs? Well, you put red lights and stop signs to create some order so you don't have as many accidents. It's not going to stop. How many people, you guys know the stats, how many people are going to die on the highways today, unfortunately? Well, how much more would it be if you didn't have stop signs and red lights and, you know, all sorts of speed limits? Come on. It's going to change. It's going to continue to change. And it has to, or else the sport's going to get, you know, less and less popular at the youth level. And it will still be popular from a fan standpoint. But I can tell you, we don't see the effects yet, but we're going to see them in 5 to 10 years. The effects of less players playing at the youth level mean less high school players. High school numbers are down. High school numbers are down. You're still going to, when you get up to pro ball, you're still going to have plenty of numbers to fill out a pro team. That'll never be an issue. In fact, you're going to still have, in our lifetime, in the next 40, 50 years, we're still going to have enough numbers to have all levels of college football support it. The numbers will be there, but the quality won't be, because the less numbers you have, the more guys you got to put on the field. So it's actually probably going to be easier to earn a football scholarship in the next 20 years than it has been, because you got less guys competing for them at the high school level. But the quality will go down, and maybe the popularity of the sport won't, but the quality of football has already had an effect. Now, you've heard me say, and you might say, boy, Chris, what, you're an idiot. You're hypocritical, because aren't you the one that talks about you should practice more? Yeah, they should practice more. Here's what I think should be done. I think you should practice football more all year round and then back off. But what is not taught well is how to tackle. You know, first of all, people like the headshot. Tackling was never, even in the old days, about hitting with your head. It never should be hitting with your head. There's never anything good with that. You need to tackle with your shoulder. Tackling is poorly taught. We don't teach it well. We don't teach it enough. What needs to be done, first of all, is the sport needs to be taught properly in a more safe fashion. I think as the advancements take place to where we don't have as many numbers to hit against other people, we're going to see more and more like they're doing in the Ivy League. Like Dartmouth, Coach Buddy Tevens, they have those robots now that they tackle that are safer. They move. You can make them move. You can make them scoop. You can do a lot of different things so you can simulate, you know, positioning and tackling and blocking without having to hit and hit and hit and cause some of the problems, because that's where the issues take place. You hit a lot in practice and you have repeat hits, and then you get in a game and you get a hit and boom, it has the cumulative effect. So there are a lot of things that we're going to do from an advancement standpoint that need to be done. But the game needs to become, I think, more skill. It needs to become about how to properly tackle, not necessarily to have the huge, big hit that shows up on highlights. And it's amazing that the same people running the TV networks, that glorify the big hit are the ones that come on with the news story about another guy's got CTE. What are you doing, football, about making it safer? Yet, well, maybe not glorifying it is a part of the issue. It's the reason why they stopped, you know, video and streakers on the football field. They didn't want to encourage them, knuckleheads, to do that. Well, maybe if you stop glorifying these people, maybe you have less of an issue with people trying to become, quote-unquote, part of the highlights, get their 15 seconds of fame. I think as we move forward as a football society, and those of us that are involved in the working part of it, need to teach the game better and need to put things in place to teach the game better in a better, more systematic way. And then I think we need to accept some of the rule changes and adjust to it. Yeah, there are going to be a lot of penalties, and there are going to be a lot of judgment calls. But when you do that, and here's what's the frustrating part as a fan, the games get too long, and then it becomes a business issue and a product issue. You've got to work through all this together. You've got to be able to teach guys to do it correctly. And when you put in rules, then they begin to affect behavior patterns of how you go about playing the game of football. Again, folks, not to be cute, but there was a point in time when they first invented cars, there was no stop sign. People just rode, and they just kind of rode whatever, and they put some horns and they blew against one another, and they go wrong side of the road. There wasn't a wrong or right side of the road. There's just dirt roads. And well, we grew, right? We had interstate highways and highways within the communities. Then you drove on certain side of the road. Then you had stop signs. Folks, you can't sit there. I mean, you have to advance as a society, and you have to advance as a football society. So where we are is a sport that's under a lot of scrutiny and heavily criticized at maybe levels that you as a fan don't get to see or hear. But it's affecting the sport at the youth level, which eventually is going to have an effect. And listen, I say this, it's not going to happen in my lifetime. But some of you younger listeners will, it may affect, you know, how you view the game down the road and how popular the game is down the road. I think it's important that we take measures. And I think what the NFL has done has been positive, probably not enough. They need to take leadership. I think there needs to be a college football coalition that looks at a lot of things. We've talked about this at the seminar recently that I spoke at, about putting together ways that we can modify this, because we don't practice and modify enough how college players are taught and practiced. I think you can be tough. I think you can be physical, but I think you can be smart. And I don't think you have to take the toughness out of the game by being smart about how you teach tackling and blocking to make it a safer game. Any thoughts or further questions on that? I'll be glad to answer them. I went a little long on that. Want to get to some questions recently asked of me. So I'll get to a few of them. Richard from Tampa asks about my assessment of Dirk Koetter as a head coach for the Bucs. I think it's been very inconsistent, Richard. You know, there's no question that when he was hired by Lovey, it was to run and to run an offense, to work with quarterback. They were going to draft one. He did prefer Mariota, but he came on board with the idea of taking Winston. That's what Jason Light and Lovey wanted, and he was okay with it. I think he liked Winston, but I think he liked Mariota a little bit more. And I based that only with my dealings with the Bucs and that staff prior to that draft. I don't think Jameis has developed nearly as well as some of the quarterbacks that have been drafted in future years after him. That's a lot on Jameis, but that's some on Dirk too. I don't think they've done enough of the offense. I don't think they've done enough as a team. Listen, I think that Dirk was a candidate to move on. I think he played his hand a little strong. And Jason Light, who wanted to get more control himself, they kind of forced Lovey out. Some people think it's justified from a football standpoint. That's fine. From a loyalty standpoint, it was not a good look for Dirk. Certainly not a good look for Jason. And they haven't had success. The Bucs have not had success. It's going to be a pivotal year for them. But to this point, I think I'm kind by saying it's been inconsistent. It's been average. It's probably been a little bit less than average. In your opinion, he asked, do you see South Florida and Central Florida going into the Power Five within the next 5 or 10 years? Richard, let me answer this in a broad view. I don't have the answer to that. Let me say this. I think that those are two as good a candidates to get invited based if there is a growth of the Power Five schools. And let me explain that. First of all, I think Houston, USF, and UCF, even more so than Boise, have a great chance of, if again, there is more schools promoted into the Power Five to be them. There's a great talent base there in terms of Florida. We talked about players. There's just a lot of talent. The facilities are good. I think there's a lot of resources for them to be there. I think BYU is another one because they've got financial resources. Houston, population base, and resources. All those schools, and certainly USF and UCF, to answer your question, would have a good chance if there's an increase in Power Five. But will there be one? Here's the issue that I think fans kind of miss out on. USF and UCF, very impressive. But what do they bring financially to the Big 12, for example? I mean, are they going to bring in more money? That would have to be studied. If those schools, for example, would bring in a lot more money in terms of a television contract, possibly. The reality is, you know this, Richard, as well as I do, Central Florida and South Florida are new schools, meaning you're starting to get a fan base built. Their programs have been relevant enough and good enough, quite frankly, to have a fan base that goes to school there, maybe grows up and follows them, goes to school there, and then are alums. You have to have that. You're fighting up against the Floridas, the Florida States, the Miamis, just in state that, I mean, they go back, you know, just years and years and years and years of following. These schools are young and new. So I don't know that they would bring financially enough to make the Big 12 move on. The Big 12 is the conference that you got to watch. If Texas wants to stay in the Big 12, the Big 12 will still exist with their current schools, and will only add if one of these schools that we're talking about is going to add more financially to the pie. Because in order to cut the pie in one or two more pieces, you have to have a much bigger pie. So what are these schools going to do to make that pie significantly bigger to where when they split the pie two more ways, it's more money for everyone as opposed to just divvying up two more pieces of the pie, that revenue pie? That's what you have to understand. And I don't know, quite frankly, that those schools can. Boise can't. BYU, maybe not. Maybe not. Houston, maybe. Watch Texas when their contract runs out with the Longhorn Network, with ESPN. When the Longhorn Network runs out with ESPN, what type of TV deal can they do? If they get a Big 12 deal done and get the lion's share of that money like they do, where they get more money than other schools, they're not an even split between those TV contracts. If they can get that and get their cake and eat it too, the Big 12 will stay. If they don't get the TV deal that they want, then Texas could hook up with the Pac-12. Or the SEC, more likely the Pac-12, and leave. Once they do, Oklahoma leaves with them, and the Big 12 is dead. So I bring this up, Richard, because South Florida and Central Florida could end up in the Big 12 tomorrow, and then within, you know, 6 months, be back into a Group of Five school and lose out to the Power Five. Because the Power Five schools in the Big 12, they would be swallowed up. You know who I'm talking about. You're talking about Texas. We're talking about Oklahoma. Talking about TCU. Talking about Oklahoma State, West Virginia. You know those. But you know, quite frankly, the Kansas States, the Texas Tech, the Iowa States, you know, West Virginia would get picked up. You know, you'd get the six schools in that league would get swallowed up by the other conferences. And then what does the rest of the Big 12 look like? They look like Conference USA, Mountain West schools. That's what they look like. So even if they get into a Big 12 and get into a Power 5, they could just as quickly fall out. Would the ACC, the SEC, the Big Ten, the Pac-12 be interested in South Florida and Central Florida? No, they would not. So I don't know if that answers your question. Hopefully it does. Kevin asks, has been enjoying your recent podcast explaining cover 1, 2, 3, and 4. Can you explain the coverages you guys used against the explosive offenses of the Rams in Super Bowl 34? Also, can you please explain what coverages you didn't, which coverages you don't use and why? All right. We mixed a lot up in that Super Bowl 34 against the Rams. We played a lot of man, a lot of pressure man, but we did play a lot of zone. We played some cover 2, a little cover 3, some umbrella cover 4, but we played a lot of 2 deep man under. And we morphed that into a lot of straight man, and where we had a lot of cover 2 looks pre-snap that kind of enveloped into cover 4 because of the vertical threat of that Rams offense. We felt the need to do that. But the pressure was pretty good, and we did a good job with it. Now, late in the game, we couldn't get home with enough pressure because your pass rush gets tired. And we got beat, you know, certainly late on a play in man coverage. Pressure almost got there, but it wasn't quite enough. When you say what coverages we didn't use and why, well, there's a myriad of coverages. I just went over cover 1, 2, 3, and 4, but there are variations of all. The reason why you choose a coverage is obviously to fit what the team you're playing can do well. So, like against the Rams, you want to mix some things up. You've got to be physical with them. So that's why you want to play some cover 2. I know the Patriots did when they beat the Rams. They played a lot of cover 2, and they're very physical. But they played a lot of man coverage underneath, but they ran some zone underneath to defend the crossing routes. You have to run your defensive front and your defensive coverages based upon who you're playing against. What routes are they most successful at? Are they more apt to beat you vertically? What then can the quarterback do, can't do? All those things. So there's always things, Kevin, that you don't run because they don't really fit. If you don't have guys that you feel can press the outside receivers, well, you don't want to play a lot of cover 2 and try to funnel them inside if you're going to lose press. If you're going to lose press and they get outside on you, then you're in a world of hurt. They got the outside third not defended, and your corner got beat because he can't jam this receiver because your corner's not physical enough or he doesn't match well enough. So, you know, in that game, we wanted to make sure that we did our best to not get beat vertically. And we did for the most part. So you try to, again, adjust to what your strength is, but also what you think is going to work against your opponent. Matt asks about Mac Brown. He asked about a couple of coaches. Matt likes to ask about coaches. Does a really good job with his questions. Matt asks, Mac Brown builds Texas into a national championship winner and then a contender, and then after Colt McCoy leaves, the team consistently worsens until they're below average. What happened? What changed? All I've heard is that Brown let the program get soft. What does that mean? Well, you heard that for me because I probably said that more than anybody. Can you provide the truth about what changed at the University of Texas? How did Brown build a program into a champion? What dynamic causes teams to erode and perform so quickly? He built the program with great recruiting. Come over from North Carolina, and I've known Mac since he was an assistant at LSU. Known him very well. A lot of film sessions, eating M&Ms with Mac Brown. Goes on, recruited well. He did a nice job at Appalachian State. At one point, did a good job recruiting at Tulane. Gets the North Carolina job, recruited extremely well there. Mac's a salesman. Mac's strength is he can sell people to buy into the program. He got North Carolina to build some of the best facilities you can imagine. Really good recruiter. So he does that at Texas with all the great resources. He recruits very well, hires a very good staff. He has things in place. They win. He delegates very well, and they win, and they become a power. Here's the problem. Staff hires, he loses certain guys. He doesn't replace them. He goes for the hot name guy. He's kind of the defensive coordinator du jour of the day. He doesn't make good, well-thought-out decisions on his coaching staff, and the program begins to slip. Recruiting slips because of bad coaching hires. He doesn't work as hard. He becomes more of a CEO. They begin recruiting off a list. So they're recruiting a lot of these Johnny Five Stars in Texas, and they don't do a good enough job of evaluating players in recruiting. So they get a lot of these, what I call entitled fat cat recruits, and they don't work them very hard. Strength program really got weak. They didn't work these guys hard enough, doing the right things, and they became content. See, that's the difference between what a Mack Brown did, what a Nick Saban did. Mack Brown didn't keep his thumb on the pulse. Mack Brown didn't preach toughness. Mack Brown didn't teach last year doesn't matter. It's what you do this year like Nick Saban does. Mack Brown got fat and happy, and that's what happened to his program. It became soft. I saw it going in there scouting every year. I saw tough guys that worked hard, and all of a sudden they became practices weren't really hard. They weren't really organized. They weren't really taught very good technique. They were not as strong. You could tell the weight room numbers went down. They're not spending time in the weight room. That's why the numbers are down. All of a sudden, that's what you got. You got a soft program. That's what happened. Then the decline happened. Then we're going to fix it. We're going to hire this hotshot coach. He's going to change things. It doesn't happen. You can't change culture with one or two hires. It was a culture problem that got soft that led to his problem, and that was that. A couple other questions on coaches from Matt. Can you evaluate Gus Malzahn as a head coach? He's a good coach, considering his achievements, considering winning a national championship as a coordinator, reached another championship game as a head coach, but meteoric rise. What's Gus all about? Gus is all about really good offensive mind. He's a really good, was at high school, really innovative, and got an awful lot out of talent in high school, which is really tough to do because you can't recruit in high school. You have to get what you have there. And you ask about is when he joined, can you explain the unique circumstances when he joined Arkansas staff with Houston, then transferred later? Well, he came in, there was a lot of pressure by Houston Nutt to bring in Gus Malzahn, who is, a high school coach in Arkansas. Comes in, and, of course, he's going to do his thing and his spread, and all of a sudden they bring in Mitch Mustaine, his high school quarterback, and Mitch Mustaine is there, and they're going to throw the football and do all this. One problem, Houston Nutt had three great running backs, Felix Jones, Darren McFadden, Peyton Hillis, could run the football, and they were really good, protected their defense. Houston did a good job. Well, he wasn't going to let Gus run his offense. He was going to do what was best for the team and for the program. Well, Gus, you know, that Mitch Mustaine left. Gus didn't feel like he could, you know, run his offense, so he left. Well, Houston, again, it's one thing. It reminded me a lot like what they forced Ed Orgeron to hire Matt Canada and were surprised when it didn't work out. Well, guess what? That's what happens. That's why you got to be strong administratively. And in those cases, Arkansas and in LSU's case, administratively been very poor. Gus is a really good teacher. He understands his offense, but he's not real flexible. He understands his offense well, but he doesn't. He's brought in with Chip Lindsey, a guy that has kind of expanded his offense some and has helped him improve the passing game. So I think he's growing as a head coach. But he's a really good strategic guy on offense, understanding the power run spread scheme. That's his strength. The problem is that as he's tried to learn how to become a head coach, he hasn't always hired very well. That's why, when you get a Cam Newton, you spike up. You get a Nick Marshall that you get to run the offense, team's really good. You don't have that quarterback, boom, that offense is just he doesn't have multiple ways to figure out how to beat you. Now, they're going to be pretty good this year. They've got a good quarterback, but they got a quarterback that also can throw the football. So I think, to answer your question, when I evaluate Gus Malzahn, he is a growing and developing head coach that's really good at running his power spread offense, not overly advanced at having a variety of concepts that he can turn to offensively, But one of the nice moves he's made is with Chip Lindsey and Chip's help. Now, if that doesn't work out long term, Chip's not there, is he going to bring in somebody going to make a good hire? That's where it becomes difficult, is your head coach has to know how to consistently hire well. And in the case that we talked about, Mack Brown, not very good, not consistent. Jim Harbaugh, great coach, hasn't hired good assistants consistently. And defensively, yes. Offensively, not so much. He's changed a lot. Gus, same thing. Those are probably the most underappreciated, misunderstood parts of being successful as a head coach, is hiring and keeping the staff together. All right, we've got a few more questions. We've got another one on Pete Carroll from Matt and some others. We're going to get to that, run a little bit long today. We're going to get to the look at the NFC coordinators, look at the Arizona Cardinals and the toughest schedules in college football and teams going up and down. We're going to get to that on Thursday. We spent a lot of time talking on football. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope it wasn't too much. But it was something that was on my mind as we celebrate the 4th of July and I think about the birth of our country. Be safe out there and have a great time with your family and whatever you choose to do. When I think about the country and where the country's been and as it relates to football, I thought it was timely. So wanted to get to some of that, and we'll get to the rest on Thursday. Want to remind you that we've got our summer savings special that's still going on, only for a limited time. Get our team previews, our daily notebooks, everything going on around the college and pro game, 50% off any subscription package by using the coupon code SUMMER. Do it today. Have the football season locked up for lowest rate ever. Folks, you get the football season for free if you sign up for your year membership right now. What a great opportunity. Another thing I wanted to mention to you. If you want us to promote your business, and we've been able to help some people a lot, contact us at chris@landryfootball.com. Hit the contact page on the website. Either way, just give me a holler. We'll be glad to put something together for you to help and grow your business. We can grow your brand right here at LandryFootball.com. So check us out, and we'll talk to you on Tuesday. Have a great 4th, everyone. God bless. God bless America. And we'll talk some more football on Thursday, coming off your 4th holiday. Take care, everybody.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is a Crush Performance Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
So what are the odds of going pro? Well, some of the numbers from the NCAA are pretty revealing when we consider the probability of an athlete competing beyond high school. The most recent numbers look at the entire pool of high school athletes and give us a percentage of how many go on to play NCAA. And then as that talent pool funnels down, how many NCAA players actually sign major pro contracts? Well, in basketball, coming out of high school, 3.4% of all those players go on to play NCAA. From the NCAA, 1.2% go on to sign major pro contracts. Men's baseball, an interesting one, 7.1% of high school players go on to play NCAA baseball, and that's a number that's growing. We're seeing the college route become more and more popular in the game of baseball because Major League Baseball is now promoting that as an avenue for development. Now, out of that NCAA pool, 9.5% of college baseball players go on to play professional baseball. In football, out of all the high school football players, 6.9% play in the NCAA, which is the main training ground for future NFL players. 1.6% of NCAA players go on to play pro. So the odds are stacked against you, but somebody has to play.
Crush Performance with the Crusher, Jeff Crichel, can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.